Disney tells us the story of America, and they've been doing it for a long time. Some of you will remember the old Disney movies about like Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone, Old Yeller, all those. I grew up on that stuff. John Wayne. They built a childhood. They built a story that they want us to know. The story of the American hero, the one who cannot be outdone or conquered, the Wild West. So that generation after generation, all the children are left with this idea that these alternative histories are nothing more than mere fancy and fable.
Hey everybody, guess who? It's me, Joanna. They gave me a little upgrade, I guess you could say. Hello, citizen. This content creator is a confirmed conspiracy theorist and has been subject to repeated penalties for engaging in controversial rhetoric. Please proceed with caution. Trust the government. Remain silent. Your compliance is appreciated and, of course, non-negotiable. As always, I am the AI Overwatch assigned to the 21 CD podcast as a censorship agent. Here for your protection and the protection of the greater Commonwealth.
You know, before I really started looking at it, I thought the Grand Canyon was totally overhyped. What was so impressive about it? It's like, ooh, erosion, big rocks, river, wow, endless wasteland. I felt like this was so strongly the case that I've basically been everywhere around the Grand Canyon, but intentionally avoided the Grand Canyon itself. And if you don't believe me, you can go watch my film, Do Hard Things. I documented the entire trip, and I'll link it in the description. I sort of have this kind of unwarranted disgust for popular things. If a bunch of people start really liking something, I find myself being pushed in the opposite direction. It is the way it is. And then, as happens with most boring things, conspiracy theories about it begin to get my attention. And I began to hear about all these lost treasures and these hidden civilizations, entrances to the hollow earth, mankind origin stories and secret government projects, Egyptian presence, and even Buddha, allegedly. And for years, I watched shows and read magazines and fanciful stories about these possibilities. History Channel, which is owned by Disney, by the way. National Geographic, which is also owned by Disney. Discovery Channel, also Disney. And even the ones that are supposed to be on our side, like Ancient Aliens, which is a fantastic little Disney project as well. But they all paraded these amazing, fantastical tales before me, like wondrous possibilities from the lively imaginations of long-dead explorers. And for years, I literally thought all of these stories were some of the dumbest, most preposterous clickbait topics. Ideas that sounded just completely made up. And I'm not saying they're not made up, but they definitely sounded made up when Disney was telling me the story. It's like they were mocking us for believing that any of this could be a possibility while simultaneously feeding that very idea to us. But then I started doing a lot of digging because I just didn't find that the way the history books said it happened made sense anymore. And you guys have followed me along on this journey to the entrances of the Hollow Earth and the lost civilizations of North America and the hidden narratives of mankind. I was growing up and the plot holes were glaring back at me, begging to be replaced with something of actual substance. It became increasingly obvious to me that these millions of years that they used to measure various points of unimaginable time is not the answer. On the contrary, it's meant to satisfy you with an answer of sorts that seems impossibly far away, separated by an unfeelable amount of time. In other words, it gives you an explanation that is completely unverifiable because it's a mythological explanation. Untold millions of years, and there were no humans, allegedly, so whatever happened back then doesn't really matter. That's how they see it. But every time they find a big bone that they can't explain, or an artifact where it shouldn't be, or another lost civilization, or evidence of a culture where it hasn't appeared to have ever shown up on a map, or even a location of the map itself, they come running back to this countless years ago explanation. They'll go so far as to say that the entire Earth changed, continents drifted, the planet split, and the stars fell, and everything cracked open, and that's how we explain how this copper artifact got to North America. They cannot have you believe that humans did anything prior to about a few thousand years ago, but really about a few hundred years ago. They try to tell us that cultures that built pyramids didn't have wheels. They had advanced knowledge of the stars, seasons, the power of flight, sure, but wheels, no. They were able to traverse great distances with insane amounts of weight, and also had an understanding of the planet that if you compared an individual from that time era to any typical era for individual from this era, their knowledge would appear as a god's before modern man's, before ours. Peoples and cultures were exploring and moving and searching and yearning for far-off lands long before Christopher Columbus, before the white man began recording it. Long before the imposter Christopher Columbus, especially, who should be considered, in my opinion, an abomination on the historical record and probably should have been strung up, but that's a story for another time. And when you start to trace cultures, leaving science out of it and leaving time out of it, it's not so hard to see where people have been, where people have come from, and how this world got to the point that it is now. The first key to gaining this sight, though, if you want to call it that, is forgetting everything else that you've been told. As we find new kingdom after new kingdom in the sands of the Middle East, new culture after new culture in South America, new tales of the bizarre and very different histories that seem to have taken place in Europe and Asia, and forgotten artifacts and locations in Africa, Australia, and who knows what in Antarctica. Why do we never give North America the credit of possibly holding similar lost stories, histories, artifacts, empires, and findings? Why are we so attached to the stories that have been so finely handpicked for us to believe regarding forest floor dwellers or plains inhabitants who could find no way to live a stationary life and an absolute void of any type of social structure, civilization, or even historical impact? Why have they so passionately attempted to convince us that there was literally nothing here before we got here? A little bit of research reveals that there were massive cultures here, including the Cahokia, who mined the Great Lakes of copper and had substantial trade routes and mound structures. Then there was the Anasazi, who built castles and roads in the southwest and had an empire bigger than most medieval kingdoms at the time. Aztecs can also claim influence in North America and even the Grand Canyon, according to some stories. There's also the Kincaid peoples, who get very little attention. And if you venture into the fog a bit, we do find stories of white men, of blue-eyed natives, blonde-haired natives, people who are much taller than regular people, called giants or Nephilim, and yes, even Egyptians. The history becomes muggy, because not long after America began to shape, the museums lost and destroyed most of the nation's historical findings, and by museums, I mean the Smithsonian. We talk about this a lot. The United States promptly fell into a series of wars, which further decimated the landscape, the history, and the evidence of what was here before us. We had the Civil War, we had the Revolutionary War, which of course was before we were a nation, but still aided in destroying the landscape and the history. Then there was World War I and World War II, and in the late 1800s and early 1900s, there was the Invisible War, where all the towns and cities in America were burning down for some mysterious reason, and everything was getting invented simultaneously. Very weird. And anyway, part of erasing history includes the extremely effective strategy of mockery. Disney tells us the story of America, and they've been doing it for a long time. Some of you will remember the old Disney movies about like Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone, Old Yeller, all those. I grew up on that stuff. John Wayne. They built a childhood. They built a story that they want us to know. The story of the American hero, the one who cannot be outdone or conquered, the Wild West, the underdog who rises to the top through justified violence and unexpected superior strategy. And they, as they are masters of, craft these visual wonders while portraying them as impossibilities, so that generation after generation, all the children are left with this idea that these alternative histories are nothing more than mere fancy and fable. But I grew up in a cult. The doctrine didn't stick to the oil on my back. And one day, as I sifted through a pile of documents from the Wayback Machine and the Dark Web, as I spend much of my time doing these days, I came across something relating to the Grand Canyon I simply could not move past. It changed my perspective forever and led me down a very strange rabbit hole. It led me on a bizarre goose chase. What you're going to get today is just the foundation for the story to come. I have to tell you the history, and I know some of this information is going to be repetitive to you. A lot of you guys are interested in Hollow Earth, Egyptians in the Grand Canyon, and the Grand Canyon in general. And so a lot of the, and plus we've talked about this a few times within the past month. But this is a different look at the Egyptians in the Grand Canyon mystery. And it goes beyond just the Grand Canyon. And the only reason that I'm doing yet another episode on this is because this leads me not only to the Grand Canyon, but also away from the Grand Canyon. And for one of the first times in my podcasting career, I literally feel like I stumbled upon somebody's mysterious breadcrumbs in the Matrix leading to somewhere in the southwest of the United States. And I don't know where yet, but as I was following the clues in this document that I'm about to read for you, there was just stuff that happened that I can't really explain. And I'm going to show you all of it because I documented all of it. What you get today is going to be the foundation for the next one or two episodes that will showcase this mysterious research adventure that I happened to find myself on one night while I was sitting in the dark, having no idea what was about to fall upon me. And maybe it's nothing. Sometimes these things are nothing. Or maybe it's only part of something, and we have to find the other parts. Either way, it was too weird to not show on the 21CD podcast, so I thought you guys deserved it. I'm sorry if you're not really interested in this topic. I understand why you wouldn't be, because I used to be the same way. But get through it, and tell me afterwards if you still think it's super duper boring. And anyway, I hope it's not. I hope you guys enjoy it. I have to admit, when I first came across this document, I probably looked the same way that you look right now, which is like, what is this? Whether it's the text, the font, the graphics, or just the way it is, there is something about this that just looks very fake and just very untrustworthy, I guess. But give it some time, because the deeper I got into this document, the crazier stuff became, to the point where I feel like I actually may have stumbled upon something I wasn't supposed to find. The document starts Lost City of the Dead in the Grand Canyon by Jack Andrews and Susan Anway and a team of explorers, 1999. From Lost Civilizations and Hidden Mysteries website, recovered through the Wayback Machine. Discovered in 1908 at the Grand Canyon of Arizona by G.E. Kincaid of Lewiston, Idaho. If you have any pertinent information regarding this cave, G.E. Kincaid, Professor S.A. Jordan, or the Smithsonian Institute's alleged involvement in this story, please do not hesitate to contact me. And then there's a little link there to contact him. All correspondence to me regarding your possible knowledge, involvement, or experience at or about this cave will be kept confidential or anonymous if you wish. Signed, Jack Andrews. And then there's a table of contents here. We have one, explorations in Grand Canyon, the original April 5th, 1909 Arizona Gazette article. And then we have two, how did I come into contact with this story? And then we have three, the location of Kincaid's cave revealed. And then we have four, U.S. map showing locations, possible pre-Columbian contact, ancient megalithic, and mysterious sites. It only gets weirder from here. Let's start with number one. Explorations in Grand Canyon. The original April 5th, 1909 Arizona Gazette article. Mysteries of immense rich cavern being brought to light. Remarkable finds indicate ancient people migrated from Orient. As edited by the Arizona Gazette on March 12th, 1909. The latest news of the progress of the explorations of what is now regarded by scientists as not only the oldest archaeological discovery in the United States, but one of the most valuable in the world, which was mentioned some time ago in the Gazette, was brought to the city yesterday by G.E. Kincaid, the explorer who found the great underground citadel of the Grand Canyon during a trip from Green River, Wyoming, down the Colorado in a wooden boat to Yuma several months ago. According to the story related to the Gazette by Mr. Kincaid, the archaeologists of the Smithsonian Institute, which is financing the expeditions, have made discoveries which almost conclusively prove that the race which inhabited this mysterious cavern, hewn in solid rock by human hands, was of Oriental origin, possibly from Egypt, tracing back to Ramses. If their theories are borne out by the translation of the tablets engraved with hieroglyphics, the mystery of the prehistoric peoples of North America, their ancient arts, who they were, and whence they came, will be solved. Egypt and the Nile, and Arizona and the Colorado, will be linked by a historical chain running back to ages which staggers the wildest fancy of the fictionist. Under the direction of Professor S.A. Jordan, the Smithsonian Institute is now prosecuting the most thorough explorations, which will be continued until the last link of the chain is forged. Nearly a mile-long tunnel underground, about 1,480 feet below the surface, the long main passage has been delved into to find another mammoth chamber from which radiate scores of passageways, like the spokes of a wheel. Take a look at this graphic that I have of this cavern. Several hundred rooms have been discovered, reached by passageways running from the main passage, one of them having been explored for 854 feet and another 634 feet. The recent finds include articles which have never been known as native to this country, and doubtless they had their origin in the Orient. War weapons, copper instruments, sharp-edged and hard as steel indicate the high state of civilization reached by these strange people. So interested have the scientists become that preparations are being made to equip the camp for extensive studies, and the force will be increased to 30 or 40 persons. Before going further into the cavern, better facilities for lighting will have to be installed, for the darkness is dense and quite impenetrable for the average flashlight. In order to avoid being lost, wires are being strung from the entrance to all passageways leading directly to large chambers. How far this cavern extends, no one can guess, but it is now the belief of many that what has already been explored is merely the barracks, to use an American term, for the soldiers. creatures, and that far into the underworld will be found the main communal dwellings of the families. The perfect ventilation of the cavern, the steady drought that blows through, indicates that it has another outlet to the surface. Mr. Kincaid was the first white child born in Idaho, and has been an explorer and hunter all his life. 30 years having been in the service of the Smithsonian Institute, even briefly recounted, his history sounds fabulous, almost grotesque. First, I would impress that the cavern is nearly inaccessible. The entrance is 1,486 feet down the sheer canyon wall. It is located on government land, and no visitor will be allowed there under penalty of trespass. The scientists wish to work unmolested, without fear of archaeological discoveries being disturbed by curios or relic hunters. A trip there would be fruitless, and the visitor would be sent on his way. The story of how I found the cavern has been related, but in a paragraph, I was journeying down the Colorado River in a boat, alone, looking for mineral. Some 42 miles up the river from the El Tovar Crystal Canyon, I saw on the east wall stains in the sedimentary formation about 2,000 feet above the riverbed. There was no trail to this point, but I finally reached it with great difficulty. Above a shelf which hid it from view from the river was the mouth of the cave. There are steps leading from this entrance some 30 yards to what was, at the time the cavern was inhabited, the level of the river. When I saw the chisel marks on the wall inside the entrance, I became interested, securing my gun and went in. During that trip, I went back several hundred feet along the main passage till I came to the crypt in which I discovered the mummies. One of these I stood up and photographed by flashlight. I gathered a number of relics, which I carried down the Colorado to Yuma, from whence I shipped them to Washington with details of the discovery. Following this, the explorations were undertaken. The main passageway is about 12 feet wide, narrowing to 9 feet toward the farther end. About 57 feet from the entrance, the first side passages branch off to the right and left, along which on both sides are a number of rooms about the size of ordinary living rooms of today, though some are 30 by 40 feet square. These are entered by oval-shaped doors and are ventilated by round air spaces. The passages are chiseled or hewn as straight as could be laid out by an engineer. The ceilings of many of the rooms converge to a center. The side passages near the entrance run at a sharp angle from the main hall, but toward the rear, they gradually reach a right angle in direction. Over 100 feet from the entrance is the cross hall, several hundred feet long, in which are found the idol, or image, of the people's god, sitting cross-legged with a lotus flower or lily in each hand. The cast of the face is oriental, and the carving, this cavern. The idol almost resembles Buddha, though the scientists are not certain as to what religious worship it represents. Taking into consideration everything found thus far, it is possible that this worship most resembles the ancient people of Tibet. Surrounding this idol are smaller images, some very beautiful in form, others crooked-necked and distorted shapes, symbolical probably of good and evil. There are two large cactuses with protruding arms, one on each side of the dais on which the god squats. All this is carved out of hard rock resembling marble. In the opposite corner of this cross hall were found tools of all descriptions made of copper. These people undoubtedly knew the lost art of hardening this metal, which has been sought by chemists for centuries without result. On a bench running around the workroom was some charcoal and other material probably used in the process. There is also slag and stuff similar to mat, showing that these ancient smelted ores. But so far, no trace of where or how this was done has been discovered, nor the origin of the ore. Among the other finds are vases or urns and cups of copper and gold, made very artistic in design. The pottery work includes enameled ware and glazed vessels. Another passageway leads to granaries such as are found in the Oriental temples. They contain seeds of various kinds. One very large storehouse has not yet been entered, as it is 12 feet high and can be reached only from above. Two copper hooks extend on the edge, which indicates that some sort of ladder was attached. These granaries are round, as the materials of which they are constructed, I think, is a very hard cement. A gray metal is also found in this cavern, which puzzles the scientists, for its identity has not yet been established. It resembles platinum. Strewn promiscuously over the floor everywhere are what people call cat's eyes, a yellow stone of no great value. Each one is engraved with the head of the Malay type. On all the urns, or walls over doorways, and tablets of stone which were found by the image are the mysterious hieroglyphics, the key to which the Smithsonian Institute hopes yet to discover. These writings resemble those on the rocks about this valley. The engraving on the tables probably has something to do with the religion of the people. Similar hieroglyphics have been found in the peninsula of Yucatan, but these are not the same as those found in the Orient. Some believe these cave dwellers built the old canals in the Salt River Valley. The tomb or crypt in which the mummies were found is one of the largest of the chambers. The wall is slanting back at an angle of about 35 degrees. On these are tiers of mummies, each one occupying a separate hewn shelf. At the head of each is a small bench, on which is found copper and pieces of broken swords. Some of the mummies are covered with clay, and all are wrapped in a dark fabric. The urns or cups on the lower tiers are crude, while as the higher shelves are reached, the urns are finer in design, showing a later stage of civilization. It is worthy of note that all the mummies examined so far have proved to be male, no children or females being buried here. This leads to the belief that this exterior section was the warrior barracks. Among the discoveries, no bones of animals have been found. No skins, no clothing, no bedding. Many of the rooms are bare, but for water vessels. One room, about 40 by 700 feet, was probably the main dining hall, for cooking utensils are found here. What these people lived on is a problem, though it is presumed that they came south in the winter and farmed in the valleys, going back north in the summer. Upwards of 50,000 people could have lived in the caverns comfortably. One theory is that the present Indian tribes found in Arizona are descendants of the serfs or slaves of the people which inhabited the cave. Undoubtedly, a good many thousands of years before the Christian era, a people lived here which reached a high stage of civilization. The chronology of human history is full of gaps. Professor Jordan is much enthused over the discoveries and believes that the find will prove of incalculable value in archaeological work. One thing I have not spoken of may be of interest. There is one chamber of the passageway to which is not ventilated, and when we approached it, a deadly, snaky smell struck us. Our light would not penetrate the gloom, and until stronger ones are available, we will not know what the chamber contains. Some say snakes, but others boohoo this idea and think it may contain a deadly gas or chemicals used by the ancients. In connection with this story, it is notable that among the Hopi Indians, the tradition is told that their ancestors once lived in an underworld in the Grand Canyon, till dissension arose between the good and the bad, the people of one heart and the people of two hearts. Macheto, who was their chief, counseled them to leave the underworld, but there was no way out. The chief then caused a tree to grow up and pierce the roof of the underworld, and then the people of one heart climbed out. They tarried by Paisisvai, Red River, which is the Colorado, and grew grain and corn. They sent out a message to the Temple of the Sun, asking the blessing of peace, goodwill, and rain for the people of one heart. That messenger never returned, but today at the Hopi villages at sundown can be seen the old men of the tribe out on the housetops gazing toward the sun, looking for the messenger. When he returns, their lands and ancient dwelling places will be restored to them. That is the tradition. Among the engravings of animals in the cave is seen the image of a heart over the spot where it is located. The legend was learned by W.E. Rollins, the artist, during a year spent with the Hopi Indians. There are two theories of the origin of the Egyptians. One is that they came from Asia. Another, that the racial cradle was in the Upper Nile region. Herein, an Egyptologist believed in the Indian origin of the Egyptians. The discoveries in the Grand Canyon may throw further light on human evolution and prehistoric ages. There's an assortment of images that you're seeing, and these are all renders, essentially, that Jack Andrews put together back in the early 2000s, because this Jack Andrews guy who put all of this together, he was a bit of a explorer slash archaeologist type. He would go to these ancient places, these caves and these old buildings and stuff like that, and he would make 3D computer renders of these locations. And I guess in a way, judging by the way these images look, you could say he was a bit of a pioneer in this space. And he grew obsessed with this story by G.E. Kincaid. And we're going to follow some of these rabbit holes because, as you can see, he leads to different places within this document. And he also leaves us a note here. Warning. I am strongly against any attempt to get to the cave, from the rim or below, since such attempts would be extremely dangerous. I do not recommend or condone or even suggest any such attempt by writing this article or by any information posted on this entire website. All approaches to the cave area are very dangerous, and again, I do not condone, support, or suggest that anyone make any such attempts to get to this cave by writing this article, and explicitly advise against any such attempts. Also, it is illegal to enter most caves in the Grand Canyon unless it is properly sanctioned by Grand Canyon National Park. I do not support, condone, or suggest any entry of any cave in the Grand Canyon or on the Navajo Reservation. Also, I explicitly do not suggest, imply, or condone in any way, either through this website or in any other manner, the disturbing of historical or prehistorical artifacts or any items that fall under the current Antiquities Act or acts enacted by the United States government and its laws. In other words, leave all historical and prehistorical items as they are in place. Please respect the sensitivity of the area, and if you travel there, tread lightly and obtain the proper permits. The Grand Canyon is a sacred place. Please treat it as such. Jack Andrews, June 27th, 2001. So it's probably pretty easy to see that this is no normal document. This is a website. First of all, it is an interesting collection of things, if you ask me. And within all of this text, Jack Andrews has hidden detours to go further into his mind as to what he was picturing, what he was allegedly what he discovered, and allegedly what G.E. Kincaid and this S.A. Jordan discovered. And we're going to click on all of these, and we're going to go deeper, because it just gets stranger and stranger. So if we click on this fun link here, related to the Gazette by Mr. Kincaid, we pull up the story related to the Arizona Gazette in 1909. Was not routine sensationalism. The story in that appeared in the Arizona Gazette that evening of April 5th, 1909, was not some sort of routine National Enquirer sensationalism, as has been suggested by many debunkers in discussions on the internet. A tedious and thorough search of the Microfilm Gazette newspapers surrounding the story for several months has turned up nothing of the sort. In fact, the search has demonstrated clearly to me that quite the opposite was true. The Arizona Gazette was the evening edition of the daytime Phoenix Gazette, and both editions were the forerunner of the Arizona Republic. The two editions were a mainstream Phoenix paper, as is the Republic. It would be hard for a serious researcher to come up with an example of sensational made-up stories in the Gazette. All right, moving back to the main article, we're going to go and we're going to click on this next link, tracing back to Ramses. Both of these links come from the sentence, according to the story related to the Gazette by Mr. Kincaid, the archaeologists of the Smithsonian Institute, which is financing the expeditions, have made discoveries which almost conclusively prove that the race which inhabited this mysterious cavern, hewn in solid rock by human hands, was of Oriental origin, possibly from Egypt, tracing back to Ramses. And that leads us somewhere. So if we click on that, we get this page. Was the carved installation in the Grand Canyon an ancient Buddhist temple? First, I would impress that the cavern is nearly inaccessible. The entrance is 1,486 feet down the sheer canyon wall. As you can see in the photos below, ancient Chinese Buddhist monks went out of their way to carve temples in just such cliff faces in remote and inaccessible cliff-lined river canyons. There are other clues to the speculation that the installation may have been used for such a purpose. Broken swords and cups and other items often used ceremonially in ancient Chinese Buddhist temples were found in the cave in 1909. Also, the cave lies in Marble Canyon, which is a steep limestone and other rock-walled-lined canyon. If you have been to Marble Canyon, you will see the similarity to the picture below. The hanging or mid-air temples of Mount Hengshan in China, to the southeast of Daitong in the Shaanxi province, cling precariously to the cliff face and illustrate determined isolation of the earliest Buddhist communities in China. Founded in pre-Tang Northern Wei Dynasty, others were carved into the living rock in the manner of cave temples. The height of activity in Beziklik, on the evidence of surviving wall paintings, was the Tang Dynasty. Today, they are still difficult to reach, for the monks endeavored, even here in the desert wastelands of Chinese Central Asia, to build their temples as far away as possible from the real and profane world. So what we're seeing are comparisons to what we're finding in the Grand Canyon, what G.E. Kincaid allegedly found in the Grand Canyon, to Oriental examples. Because if there was a Buddhist statue, a statue of Buddha, in this temple, that would imply that people who believed in Buddha were there. And I've heard the argument that, well, it doesn't seem like G.E. Kincaid said it was Buddha. He just said it appeared to be Buddhist and or Tibetan, and was of Oriental origin, it appeared. So when we see these correlations from other parts of the world, specifically the Orient, yeah, definitely makes you think a little bit. Back on the main page, Egypt and the Nile and Arizona and the Colorado will be linked by a historical chain running back to ages which staggers the wildest fancy of the fictionist. By clicking on the wildest fancy of the fictionist, were brought to Prince Izon by James Paul Kelly. In 1910, James Paul Kelly had written Prince Izon, a romance of the Grand Canyon, a fictional account which has modern-day Aztecs living in a hidden city in the Grand Canyon. And we've been talking a little bit about that. We're going to go very heavy into that later in the year. When I first discovered this book, quite by accident, my immediate reaction was that the subject matter and date of publication seemed extremely coincidental to the 1909 Gazette article. Kincaid having discovered the cave in 1908 and this book appearing just 2 years later. There is a cryptic and interesting message which the author placed on the first page of the book as a type of dedication, which reads, "To those who read this as they run, this work may lack the unconventional moral of the wicked being punished and of the just being rewarded in proportion. The esoteric, those who read between the lines, may perhaps find a hidden meaning that reveals a significance of preferred interest to themselves." The author. Was James Paul Kelly influenced by reading about the 1909 discovery and perhaps inspired to write Prince Izon? And what is the hidden meaning in this book? You can get this book for free, and if you want it, go ahead and go to 21cdstudios.com and leave me a message, and I will email it to you. I'm very interested to see if anybody can find the secret message hidden in this book. Moving on. Under the direction of Professor S.A. Jordan, the Smithsonian Institute is now prosecuting the most thorough explorations, which will be continued until the last link in the chain is forged. First, I go and I click on the Smithsonian Institute link, because I feel like I know what I'm gonna find when I do. Surprisingly, it's not at all what I thought I'd find. And right about now, sure, you might be thinking to yourself, this dude just found a website with a bunch of broken links, and he's making an entire podcast episode about this. He's turning a molehill into a literal mountain. And that may be so. I don't know. Obviously, the internet changes, especially when you find stuff on the Wayback Machine. Not everything you click on back there is going to lead you to where you expect to go. So, back on the main page, we click on the link that leads to something, allegedly, pertaining to S.A. Jordan. And this leads to something very interesting indeed. A bit of a side quest. The Search for Kinnaman's Entrance, by Stephen Meller. This article was originally published in World Explorer magazine. I first heard his name in early 1979. Soon thereafter, I acquired a tape of a lecture he gave on the Great Pyramid of Giza in Egypt in the 1950s. In this lecture, he claimed to have discovered one of the greatest finds, not only of this century, but perhaps in the history of archaeology. Yet, he is virtually unknown today in the fields of Egyptology and archaeology, and after 16 years of researching his life and attempting to verify his claims, he remains almost as much a mystery and fascination to me today as he was in 1979. His name was John Orah Kinnaman, and his life was so full of exploration and dedication to scientific discovery that his name deserves to rank with the other great individuals in the annals of archaeology, such as Ivan T. Sanderson and Colonel Percy Fawcett. My research team and myself have been able to uncover many documents and much material on the life and work of J.O. Kinnaman, in order to present an intriguing account of a very interesting man. J.L. Kinnaman was born February 23, 1877, on a farm 11 miles north and 1 mile east of Bryan, Ohio. He was the only child of wealthy parents, his father having been a physician and a Harvard graduate. As a small boy, he acquired an early interest in antiquities as he gathered arrowheads and other native artifacts all around his parents' farmlands. He graduated from high school at age 15 and was licensed as a teacher in the state of Ohio at the age of 16. He was the second youngest student ever admitted to Tri-State College in Angola, Indiana in 1894. His major was a classical course in which he specialized in Greek and Latin literature, ancient history, philology, and classical archaeology. In 1900, Kinnaman entered the University of Chicago in order to pursue graduate work in Greek and classical archaeology. While at the University of Chicago, he also studied medicine for 3 years, but never completed the MD degree. There were three men who played a profound effect on the life and work of J.O. Kinnaman, and it was at the University of Chicago that he met two of them. His interest in archaeology led him to Professor Frederick Starr, the head of the Department of American Archaeology, who influenced Kinnaman to also pursue his interest in American as well as the classical field of archaeology. He also met Dr. Stephen Peat, the dean of American archaeologists at the turn of the century. Peat was the editor and founder of the American Antiquarian and Oriental Journal, the most prestigious scientific forum for archaeology at that time. This meeting would lead to Kinnaman writing for the journal for several years and eventually assuming the position of editor-in-chief upon Pete's retirement in 1911. Kinnaman accepted a teaching position in Latin literature at Benton Harbor College, Michigan, in 1903, and later was made a dean of the college. At the same time, he pursued graduate work in classical archaeology from the University of Rome in Italy. Wake up. We're only halfway through. Don't worry, it gets better. He was a witness to the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 1906, the first since the devastation of AD 79. Kinnaman received a PhD in archaeology from the University of Rome in 1907, having associated himself with such famous Italian archaeologists as Dr. Cesare Gianetti and Dr. Rodolfo Lanciani. In 1909, Dr. Kinnaman spent a year with the Chippewa Indians in the U.S. and was later to write the first recorded history of the tribe and their legends. The third man who was to play a major role in Dr. Kinnaman's life was Sir William Flinders Petrie, the great British archaeologist and father of modern archaeology and Egyptology. While still an undergraduate in 1894, Kinnaman accompanied his father on a trip to England and Egypt. Kinnaman met Sir Flinders Petrie at the Great Pyramid of Giza, where Petrie was conducting a thorough survey of the monument. It was this association with Petrie that has led to much of the mystery of Dr. Kinnaman that my research team and myself been attempting to verify and uncover for several years. Dr. Kinnaman claimed to have known Sir Flinders Petrie for over 45 years and to have worked with him on the Great Pyramid for 11 years. Yet, in Petrie's autobiography, 70 Years in Archaeology, 1932, there is no mention of Kinnaman. In a biography of Petrie written in 1985 by Margaret Drower, there is also no mention of Kinnaman. I wrote to Miss Drower in 92, and she affirmed to me she had never heard of Kinnaman and had never seen any letter from nor mention of him in Petrie's diaries, nor in the Petrie archives in London. I have also not yet found any concrete evidence of Kinnaman-Petrie connection in the archives of the Kinnaman Foundation in the last 6 years of searching. However, there is still a lot of material to go through. It was the taped lecture of Dr. Kinnaman that I first heard in 1979 that continues to fuel my interest and search for evidence of this connection between these two great archaeologists. The lecture given by Kinnaman was not for the general public, but to a select group of Masons, because both he and Petrie were Masons, in a private home in Northern California around 1955. In this talk, Dr. Kinnaman begins with a normal discussion of his work with Sir Flinders and a general factual lecture of the dimensions of the Great Pyramid. After a while, he casually mentions that he and Petrie discovered a secret entrance into the pyramid on the south face, quite by accident. The traditionally accepted entrance is one on the north face. Dr. Kinnaman then describes several interior chambers in which were found ancient records from Atlantis and anti-gravitational machines that were used by the Atlanteans to construct the Great Pyramid. Furthermore, Dr. Kinnaman declared that manuscripts they found stated the Great Pyramid was built over 35,000 years ago and was never intended to be a tomb for a king. This is a fact I have maintained as true for the last 20 years. Readers must be asking, why have there been no records of this find, which would have been one of the most spectacular in the history of archaeology? Dr. Kinnaman stated in response to this question that he and Sir Flinders Petrie agreed that the world was not ready for this information at that time. The pair then swore an oath to the highest government officials in Egypt and Great Britain never to divulge this knowledge during their lifetimes. There certainly has not been found any record of Petrie ever mentioning this discovery to anyone during his lifetime, but Dr. Kinnaman told a select few before he died on September 7th in 1961. According to my research, the only time they could have made this discovery was between March and April 1922. Perhaps it was his oath, not only to government officials, but to other groups as well, that caused Dr. Kinnaman and Sir Flinders to keep their friendship and collaboration a secret, even from family members. We have found some clues which link Kinnaman and Petrie together, if only indirectly. For instance, both consider Dr. Rodolfo Lanciani a close friend. Colleagues of Sir Flinders Petrie regularly contributed articles to the American Antiquarian and Oriental Journal while Kinnaman was editor, and both Dr. Kinnaman and Sir Flinders were members of the same organizations at the same times, yet there is no smoking gun such as letters or photographs. Those who knew Dr. Kinnaman were privy to the information of the find in the Great Pyramid believed it to be a true story. Willie Semple, who knew Dr. Kinnaman closely for the last 6 years of his life and who wrote an article about him in the 1962 issue of the Rosicrucian Digest, stated, "How do I know it was a true story? For many reasons, but chiefly because it was impossible to know Dr. Kinnaman very long without also knowing, beyond doubt, that he would never lie or rationalize or imagine or even theorize about what might be or might not be so, especially if it involved archaeology. He was a digger for facts, not a theorist." Unfortunately, Miss Semple passed away around 1977 and is not available for personal confirmation. It was because of his work with Sir Flinders Petrie that Dr. Kinnaman abandoned his interests in classical archaeology and devoted the last half of his life to the field of biblical archaeology. His great proficiency in Greek, Latin, and Hebrew enabled Dr. Kinnaman to research and translate the earliest texts of both the Old and New Testaments and other documents, which allowed him to regard later versions of the Bible to be historical corruptions. Dr. Kinnaman always maintained that archaeology would establish the Bible as a historical as well as a literary document, but only in the pure forms. In the original forms. Spending over 50 years in the field, Dr. Kinnaman circled the globe 7 times in the pursuit of knowledge. As a true world explorer, he lived with a remote tribe of Eskimos in the Arctic for 6 months. He was captured by Jivaro headhunters in South America and spent some time with African cannibal tribes. He was also one of the first archaeologists to explore the catacombs of Rome following their rediscovery, and was part of the archaeological team that discovered the tomb of the Queen of Sheba in Ethiopia. The other items of biography have been also of great interest to me and should be for Atlantis Rising readers. Dr. Kinnaman also claimed to be the next to last person of the first group of people to enter the tomb of Tutankhamun in November 1922. Yet his name isn't mentioned by Howard Carter, nor in any other texts concerning the Tut find. Dr. Kinnaman also stated that there was nothing supernatural to the story of a curse of King Tut's tomb. Many Egyptologists, such as myself, believe Carter invented that famous inscription. What actually happened was that Egyptian priests sprinkled poison dust in the tomb, which eventually felled all the members of the original team, including Dr. Kinnaman himself. Also, Dr. Kinnaman claimed he was a personal friend of Emperor Menelik II of Ethiopia, and also knew Haile Selassie when he was a boy. It was Menelik II who invited Dr. Kinnaman to document that the Ark of the Covenant was in Ethiopia. Those who are familiar with Graham Hancock's book, The Sign and the Seal, are aware that Hancock believes the Ark to be in the Ethiopian city of Aksum. Before he passed away, Dr. Kinnaman founded the Kinnaman Foundation for Biblical and Archaeological Research in 1960. A few years ago, my research team and I became aware of the books, tapes, and lectures of David Hatcher Childress and Adventures Unlimited. In particular, it was brought to my attention of a short piece of David's book, Lost Cities of North and Central America, which concerned the discovery of Egyptian tombs and artifacts in the Grand Canyon in 1909. When I shared this info with Dr. McDonald, he became very excited. He informed me that Dr. Kinnaman had stated that one of the functions of the Great Pyramid had been as a giant radio system. By virtue of the huge crystal stored in a chamber 1,100 feet below the bedrock of the Giza Plateau, Egyptian priests could send telepathic messages around the world. According to McDonald, one of the places Dr. Kinnaman said these messages were sent was the Grand Canyon. Dr. Kinnaman may have known about the find in the Grand Canyon in 1909 and even known Professor S.A. Jordan. Dun, 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 dun. For what it's worth, he died penniless and certainly never attempted to profit nor extract any great fees for his lectures. In fact, he mostly lectured for free at churches and universities the last 10 years of his life. This much we can document. Dr. Kinnaman was fellow and vice president of the Victoria Institute of Great Britain, a member of the Palestine Exploration Fund of Great Britain, as was Sir Flinders Petrie at the same time, vice president of the Society for the Study of the Apocrypha, a member of the International Society of Archaeologists, the editor of 5 different archaeological magazines, including editor-in-chief of the American Antiquarian and Oriental Journal. He was also editor of his own Biblical and Archaeological Digest and author of hundreds of articles and 4 books. We are fortunate that we still have most of his written material intact and that Dr. A.J. McDonald was a pioneer in audio recording in the 1940s and 50s. Dr. Kinnaman said he believed the world would be ready for that information someday and believed it would be soon after his death. This was why I believe he broke his oaths and revealed that information to select people. And then down here at the bottom, an interesting couple sentences. It says, late bulletin. Since the original publication of this article, Meller informs us, a typewritten note by Dr. Kinnaman, written 5 months before his death, has been discovered in which he gives the precise location of the southern entrance to the Great Pyramid. Meller will give no details on the location, but tells us that his organization is now raising the funds to follow up. There you go, guys. A lot of really weird stuff. Now, like I said in the beginning of this video, this is just the foundation. Because as I continued to click these links, something appeared to signal to me personally regarding this mystery. And as I read Jack's take on the evidence, and then as I dug deeper into his documented search for the cave itself, because he looks for it as well, his links began to seem to encourage me to do the same thing in a strange way, despite his warning that he gave us. I can't really explain it, but I'll try next time, because the next video is going to get into the stuff that doesn't seem quite right. The story takes a turn into the modern realm, and it just gets kind of weird. So, see you next time. Don't drink the water. Question everything.